Okay, first things first, it's not August 8th. I don't know how that slide got that way. It's August 13th. But I'm happy to be with you this morning. So as Jordan said, I recently finished a PhD in systematic theology, and my major focus was on a theological ethicist by the name of Stanley Hauerwas. And one of Hauerwas's sort of things is critiquing American culture and American forms of Christianity that he's worried are actually somehow less than really Christian, which is something that I've been deeply interested in. And a few years ago, I got to teach some classes in this section that were on those lines. And so what I'm doing today is I'm sort of extending that idea or extending that thought with a new thinker that I've been spending all summer with, Soren Kierkegaard. Soren Kierkegaard was a Danish philosopher and theologian. Let's see if this works. Oh, perfect. And what I want to do is I want to spend 2 weeks working through some of his thought with you. Hopefully what will happen is today's talk will be about 30 minutes, 35 minutes, and that will leave us plenty of time for question and discussion. And mainly what I want to do today is I want to introduce you to Soren. I want to give you a little bit of his biography. And then I want to overview something that is called his attack on Christendom. And what that'll do is that'll give us a good background for who this guy is and what he was trying to do, so that when we come back next week and we look specifically at his work and at two aspects of his work that I'm calling sort of his prophetic approach to Christendom and then his missional approach to Christendom, we'll be able to understand really what he meant, what he was about, and how that might help us to understand where we are today. So let's start then with a little bit of a biography about the life of Soren Kierkegaard. Soren, pronounced Soren Kierkegaard, was born May 5th, 1813, in Copenhagen, Denmark. He was the seventh and youngest child of a very successful wool merchant. His father, Michael, was a self-made man who grew up in a rural shepherding family. But because the family was so large and they had too many mouths to feed, they sent him away to Copenhagen to work for his uncle, who was a merchant. And in the course of growing up in Copenhagen and working for his uncle, he actually took over the business and became an incredibly successful businessman, becoming one of the first middle-class merchants to actually receive a license from the king to operate and trade in the Dutch East and West Indies. Now, he worked hard, he was very successful, and he was able to navigate his family through one of the largest financial depressions that Denmark faced at that time. And in fact, a lot of people of great wealth lost their fortunes. So by the time that Kierkegaard was a young adult, he had actually inherited great wealth. Now, Michael, you might say, was a man of constant sorrow. His first wife, Christine, had died within a few years of their marriage, and he married his second wife, Anne, the housekeeper, less than a year later. This was a bit of a scandal because their first child came 5 months later. They would go on to have seven children, but the first five would all die before the age of 33, leading Michael, the father, to despair that he might actually live long enough to bury all seven of his children and his second wife. Soren and his older brother Peter, in fact, did live to full age and outlived their father. Michael, for his part, blamed himself. There was sort of this mythological story from his youth where, as a shepherd, a young shepherd boy, feeling abandoned and hopeless, he stood at the edge of a cliff overlooking his sheep and cursed God. And Kierkegaard later called this sort of the great earthquake in his life when he found this out. Because it seemed that his father's whole life from that point forward was sort of regret that he had done that. And as a result, his father was deeply religious. And this is probably why he insisted on his children attending worship so frequently. In fact, we know that his family attended every Sunday morning the Church of Our Lady in Copenhagen, which was sort of the big downtown cathedral church. And the pastor there was a famous preacher, a guy named Jacob Minster, who would later become the head of the whole Danish Lutheran church. and later Kierkegaard's greatest foe. But then every Sunday evening, Michael would take his family to Moravian prayer meetings, which were more sort of down-to-earth, more participatory experiences and expressions of worship where everybody sang together and prayed. Michael was a strong financial backer of the Moravians, and he probably actually grew up Moravian before he moved to Copenhagen. So for Soren Kierkegaard, Christianity was always something that existed between these two experiences. On the one hand, the Lutheran state church, with its pomp and circumstance, sort of the definition of a Christian or a Christendom church. And then on the other hand, the Moravian prayer meetings. Now, what I mean when I say that the Danish state church was a Christendom church is that the idea was simply that if you were born in Denmark, you were baptized into that church. In fact, there was a practice of compelling baptism. So if you were born into a family that did not want you to be baptized in that way, the state could and often would actually come take you out of your family's home and baptize you. And so not only was this sort of a powerful symbol of the state's authority regarding religion, but the state actually collected the tithes. If you were a pastor in this church, you were actually a member of the state. You were a civil servant. You were paid by the state. And so what this means is that Denmark, as well as other countries in Europe, existed in this state where the church served the king, the nation. And so this was sort of the epitome of cultural Christianity. Everyone in Denmark is a Christian by virtue of the fact that they're born there, and Denmark is supposedly a Christian nation. And yet being a Christian makes absolutely no difference for how you live your life on a day-to-day basis. Now, on the other hand, there were the Moravians, like I said. And the Moravians were a pietistic renewal movement from Germany. Moravians are perhaps best known to us in America as being the folks that influenced John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, right? Now, there are still some Moravians today in America, especially down in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, near where I come from, and in Pennsylvania. But in contrast to the state church, the Moravians emphasized personal transformation, the priesthood of all believers, and a type of worship that was effective and emotional. It's very much the case that for Moravians, Christianity required a personal conversion, even if you had already been baptized as a Christian. So Soren, growing up in this context, would have understood Christianity as being something between these two things. Now, as Soren grew up, he was an awkward child. He had some sort of curvature of the spine, and so when he walked, he kind of walked in an unusual way. And he was a weak and a sickly figure. To make matters worse, his father was a spendthrift, so he often sent him to school in old clothes that were not fashionable. So as a result, you can imagine he was the target of bullying by bigger and stronger children. Now, he chose to react to this bullying by sort of engaging in a campaign of counter-bullying. He knew he was smarter than everyone else, and he had quickly learned that he could use his wit to sort of demand the attention of the whole room. And so when it suited him, he would use his wit to bully bigger and stronger people who perhaps were not as fast intellectually as him. And he would often get the upper hand. Now, as you can imagine, this type of behavior had the desired effect of humiliating his classmates, but the undesired effect of making him even more alienated, right? And so many of his classmates remember that Soren was sort of the consummate outsider. He kept to himself. He was always introspective and quiet. It seems that whenever the possibility came for sort of a genuine inclusion in the group, he self-selected to exclude himself. Maybe he knew that he was simply always going to be an outsider, or maybe he chose to be an outsider. There's probably a little bit of truth in both. But this kind of sets up his whole career as being sort of an outsider to Danish Christianity. looking on it from the outside. Now, when Soren graduated from secondary school, he matriculated into a theology degree at the University of Copenhagen. It took him 10 years to complete his bachelor's degree. It seems that he was bored with school, so he constantly preoccupied himself by attending lectures and other subjects. We know that he went to psychology lectures, philosophy lectures, art history lectures, poetry. He was also a regular fixture socially at the opera and in the cafes and the salons. In truth, he was developing a bit of a reputation as a cosmopolitan, while his studies remained incomplete. Of course, it probably didn't help that during this 10-year period, he experienced the death of both his mother and then his father, as well as three of his siblings and his brother Peter's first wife, who had lived in the family home. Now, during this 10-year period, Soren experiences a lapse from, and then subsequently a return to, Christianity. The experience led to a lifelong project of exploring the reasons why people reject Christianity and a growing discomfort with the type of Christianity that he saw around him. All of this has become known as what we're going to call Soren's attack on Christendom, which is a theme we'll talk about here in a few minutes. Now, the reason Soren finally finished his degree perhaps had less to do with his newfound faith and more to do with his newfound love. Somewhere in the middle of his studies, he met Regine Olsen. After meeting Regine, Soren decided he should quickly finish his studies. He proposed marriage, and he enrolled in seminary with the idea that perhaps he would become a rural pastor and a family man. All of this would not be, however, because as he finished writing his dissertation, that sort of sense of outsiderness, I think, kicked in again. And he decided that it perhaps would not be good for Regine to spend her life with him. So having made the decision for both of them, he breaks the engagement. And then, because he's broken the engagement, and he's sort of left her publicly, socially shamed, he decides that he must do something to raise her social status. So he becomes a well-known sort of philanderer around town. Did he actually do this? Probably not, but he took the appearance of being sort of a drunkard and a womanizer and someone that was of sort of social disrepute, according to his own diaries or biography, for the purpose of protecting her reputation. After he breaks the engagement, he becomes sort of the figure Kierkegaard that we know. Within a year and a half of the broken engagement, he publishes his first work. And within a four-year period, he publishes then 8 works. So he was a very busy person, very busy thinker and writer. Now, sort of freed from the idea of being a pastor and a family man, he devotes his whole life to writing. In February of 1843, he publishes Either Or, which is the first work in a larger project that he calls his authorship. Now, his authorship is sort of this intentional project he takes on, which we see here with these 8 published works, where he tries to intentionally create a sort of conversation about Danish Christianity. And in order to create the effect of a conversation, each work is actually published under the name of a different person. So he writes pseudonymously. And so the idea here is that these works are not necessarily steps on a ladder towards an argument he's making, so much as these are different points of view, entering into the conversation in contradictory ways, disagreeing with each other, all sort of trying to create the effect in Danish society that there's a real debate to be had about what Christianity is and should be, when in reality the debate's only taking place in Soren's head. And the idea here is that each point of view would sort of represent itself in the best possible way, and that the readers in society would take up each point of view, and they would find the point of view they most recognized as their own, and they would find that they wholly, completely agree with it. And then Kierkegaard would come behind and completely dismantle that point of view and show what the problem was with that way of thinking and why that was inconsistent with Christianity. And so finally in 1846, with his book Concluding Unscientific Postscript, he sort of lets the cat out of the bag and says, hey, guess what? I was the author of all these works all along. This is what I've been up to, and this is what I've been trying to do. A lot of people kind of knew already that it was him, so it wasn't a complete shock. It was very common for people to write pseudonymously at that point in time. And some of his names were so ridiculous that nobody believed it was the real author anyway. I'll show you some of those names later. But in Postscript, Kierkegaard finally explains what he's doing. And he sets out his main point, which is this. To be a Christian requires one to break with the culture that's around them. Not simply to disappear into the crowd of the culture around you, but to stand aside from the crowd and to stand with Jesus Christ. Now, as you might expect, Kierkegaard's campaign to save the people of Denmark from their own mistaken assumptions did not go well. Instead of being heralded as the savior of authentic Christianity, he was criticized as an arrogant and disagreeable fellow, dismissed as a lunatic, or ignored altogether. Up until this point, Kierkegaard had considered himself a type of poet, someone who used poetic and symbolic language in order to speak indirectly, in order to help people to see truths that they could not have seen had he spoken so directly. To borrow that famous expression from Emily Dickinson, Kierkegaard liked to tell it slam, right? Eugene Peterson reminded us, of course, that that's what Jesus tried to do as well. However, as Kierkegaard's period of intense writing came to a close, he discovered that his poetic approach was not having the desired effect. And so he developed a sense of urgency and he changed tactics. And so with his second set of writings, of which there are five major works, but I've only pointed out the three that I think are most important for us, he began to speak more directly. He published five books under his own name, including most famously Works of Love, which is an attempt to explicate what Jesus meant when he said, love the Lord your God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself. And then he published four more works pseudonymously. The two that I'm interested in here are Sickness Unto Death and Practicing Christianity, which he published under a new pseudonym named Anticlimacus, and we'll talk about that later. But he thought by being more blunt and to the point and more sincere about what he thought Christianity was, that maybe people would finally see what he was trying to do. As it turned out, though, his attacks on the Danish church created more enemies than it did friends. He becomes ostracized from society. He's the laughingstock of the cultured elite in Copenhagen. Regularly, cartoons like this one started appearing in the newspapers, making fun of him. Remember, I said he had a curvature of the spine. But he had this habit of sort of walking around town and randomly talking with people in the town square, in the cafes, and just sort of getting a sense of what the everyday people were doing in Copenhagen. And so it became so embarrassing that he actually quit walking around town because these sort of caricatures were popping up everywhere. Even in the end, his own brother, a pastor in the Danish state church, turned his back on him and publicly denounced his work. So at the end, he dies, having not attended church for several years. Even when his brother attempted to serve him communion on his deathbed, he refused. None of the bishops or the clergymen of the state church attended his funeral, even though he was internationally known at this point for his writing. And his funeral was at the largest church in Copenhagen. It seems that everybody was eager for him to die and to disappear. so that society could resume as normal. Now, all this is not to say that Kierkegaard was not a Christian. To the contrary, he considered himself deeply Christian. He refused to worship at the Danish church because he thought that to do so would be inauthentic, and therefore it would be a type of idolatry on his part. He also refused to take communion at the inn, not because he refused communion itself, but because the person that offered it to him, his brother, was an employee of the king. And he took this to be an inauthentic expression of Christianity. From start to finish, Kierkegaard's adult life was singularly devoted to the task of pointing people to Jesus Christ and away from all the false trappings of the cultural surroundings that made it hard for them to find Jesus. So what I want to do then with the rest of our time today is I want to briefly highlight this idea of his attack on Christendom. What was it that he didn't like about Danish Christianity, and what was it that he thought was better? Much of Kierkegaard's work was directed specifically towards this idea that there was a true Christianity and a false Christianity. False Christianity was most closely attached to that idea of the Danish culture or the cultural forms of Christianity that he observed around him. And true Christianity, as far as Kierkegaard was concerned, was the type of church that you see in the New Testament. The early disciples surrounding Jesus, and then later the apostles in Acts building the church. Remember, when I say Christendom, what I mean is simply that the church belongs to the state, church clergy members are civil servants, the church property is government property, tithes are collected in the form of a state tax. If you are a citizen, you are a member of the church. To be Danish simply is to be Christian. There's a reason why all of the Nordic states have a cross in their flag, and that's because all of these states thought of themselves as Christian nations, and they all had similar state churches. For Kierkegaard, the problem of a Christian nation is the problem of how Christianity ends up resembling something completely different and occasionally antithetical to what Christianity looks like in the New Testament. Indeed, much of what Danish culture calls Christian, Kierkegaard believes, is actually a resurgence of Denmark's pre-Christian pagan culture in the form of Danish nationalism. What Kierkegaard saw, perhaps more clearly than anyone of his generation, was that it's only a very small step from the idea of a Christian nation to the idea that our Christianity is actually the true Christianity. And then only another small step to a bunch of people standing in a courtyard in Charlottesville, Virginia, yelling blood and soil and calling themselves Christian, right? Kierkegaard, in many ways, anticipated Nazism in Germany. He saw that German culture and German Christianity, much like Danish culture and Danish Christianity, was so tied together that it could not lead to Christianity itself. It would lead instead to the elevation of the German people. Kierkegaard knew that it was far too easy to be a Christian in Denmark. Calling oneself a Christian didn't require any change in one's life. For Kierkegaard, the gospel stories about Jesus and his disciples presented Christianity as a dangerous way of life that required sacrifice. To the contrary, Danish Christianity appears safe and prosperous. In fact, Danish Christianity favored the rich and the powerful, ensuring the status quo. And it was this sort of safe aspect of Christendom that Kierkegaard hated the most. At the root of the problem of Christendom was the question of Jesus Christ. As far as Kierkegaard was concerned, Christendom reduced Christianity to paganism because it sought to have Christianity without Jesus Christ. At its heart, then, Kierkegaard's attack on Christendom is a strategic attempt to confront people who call themselves Christian with the Christ who they claim to believe. It is this conflict-causing aspect of Kierkegaard's work that has led Mark Tichin, who is the author of this work here, which you can come up and look at after class if you're interested, to suggest that Kierkegaard is both a prophet and a missionary, which will be the major thesis of next week's class. He's a prophet in the sense that he speaks to the institutional church, reminding them of their shortcomings. And at the same time, he's a missionary in the sense that this type of Christendom that he's sort of diagnosed and experienced, he realizes has become so pagan, it has become so removed from Jesus Christ, that it actually has to hear the gospel again. And so he has to try to find new ways to proclaim the gospel, because all of the old ways have become so commonplace that people don't really hear the truth of it anymore. The attack on Christendom is an intentional and prophetic attempt to force cultural Christianity to confront New Testament Christianity and to come to terms with its own disappointing shortcomings. It's a ground-clearing exercise. He's removing the debris of all other cultural preconceptions of Christianity so that their ears will be open to hear the gospel again. You might say that he's aggressively removing weeds from the garden, so that when the seeds of the gospel fall, they'll have room to grow, right? Now, I want to say one more thing about Kierkegaard's use of pseudonyms. We've already talked about it a little bit, but I want to give you some more detail here. Below is a list of some of his sort of most famous pseudonyms. Constantine Constantinius wrote a book called Repetition. So you get the sense of how his humor works there. Like I said before, Kierkegaard's authorship was his means of forcing Christendom to confront Christ again. And so by using several different points of view in this type of literary device, he was able to do two things. First, it enabled him to simulate a large conversation that represented multiple points of view for his audience. And so thus his readers would gravitate towards a point of view, and then that point of view would sort of fall away beneath them. It turns out it wasn't as foundational as they thought it was. And they would see that it contradicted Christianity. I was thinking about this recently and trying to think of what a contemporary example would be. And the best example I was able to come up with is maybe Stephen Colbert. Now, of course, Stephen Colbert is the host of The Late Show. And lately, he's been building his ratings by being a very vocal critic of Donald Trump, right? Before that, however, Colbert, became famous for hosting the Colbert Report, which, as you might remember, was this sort of satire show where he pretended to be a conservative pundit, and he would sort of represent these points of views in a way that kind of lampooned them. He would press the logic of a certain point of view to its absurd conclusion, only to help us see the flaws in some of the ways of thinking in that way. And he was actually successful at this because nobody believed that anyone could really hold that absurd point of view. So it felt like he wasn't actually insulting any particular person, right? And so the liberals loved it because it pointed out the flaws in some conservative ways of thinking. And conservatives loved it, or at least tolerated it, because it was so absurd that they could laugh at it and see a little bit of the humor of their own way of thinking without feeling like it was a personal attack on who they were. And so what Colbert wanted to do and what Kierkegaard wants to do is to force people to work through the logic of their own truth claims, to acknowledge the inconsistencies and the problems in that thinking, and then to try to find a way forward. So pseudonyms are Kierkegaard's way of sort of play-acting different characters and roles in society. Now, the second thing that pseudonyms allow Kierkegaard to do is they allow him, by using fake names and authors who are not known, to break the link in the reader's mind between the author and authority, between the name of the person who's presenting the truth and the authority that lends to the truth itself. See, one thing that he saw in Christendom was that many people thought they knew what Christianity was simply by trusting the authorities that claimed to speak in the name of Christianity. And what he wanted to do is he wanted to undermine the idea that a name could hold authority. He wanted to force people to seek the truth for themselves instead of just listening to the sort of talking heads in society that claim to represent certain positions. And so in this sense, you might say Kierkegaard was a bit pre-postmodern. He sort of intentionally bombarded his readers with fake news and alternative facts, right? Not to sell them a false bill of goods, but to help show them that the authorities that they trusted were not always necessarily trustworthy, and that different points of view could be represented in ways that contradicted each other, and both of them would be apparently false. Now, let me give you, in conclusion, a brief example of what Kierkegaard's pseudonymous work might look like. This was his first major work, Either Or. Written under the name Victor Eremita, which means the victorious hermit. It's a large two-volume work, 838 pages long. And therein he explores three prominent types of people that he observed in Christendom. The first type he calls the aesthete, someone who lives for the experience that he derives from life. The paradigmatic figure here for Kierkegaard was Don Juan, or Don Giovanni, the seducer, the man whose life centers around sensuous love. The aesthetic seducer, according to Eremita, has the appearance of culture, sophistication, and excitement, but all of that is empty. It's a carefully manicured public persona, an Instagram account. The aesthete is actually bored and selfish, constantly exploiting people in his next quest for pleasure and excitement. Eremita's second type is the ethical person. The character that he creates for this is someone named Judge William. The judge is a person who exemplifies wisdom and responsibility. He's concerned not merely for his own well-being, but also for the well-being of others. He exhorts the Don Juan figure to consider the virtues of marriage and constancy. Concerned with the eternal more than the temporal, the judge's life and the choices he makes gives him the appearance of being a more authentic person than the aesthete. Now, I say appears here for a reason. The point Eremita wants to make is that we tend to compare ourselves to others. And so in our own eyes, the judge is clearly morally superior to the seducer. The one who seeks to live by a moral code, superior to the one who lives only for pleasure. In reality, however, for Eremita, these are two sides of the same coin. The or in either or is the decision we must make between either these ways of being that place the individual's life choice at the center, whether that choice is pleasure or responsibility, or the decision to pursue a religious life. The life of the religious person is one that begins with the realization that all three, the aesthetic, the ethical, and the religious, all begin from the same place in life. That is, they all begin as sinners before God. So what makes the religious person different is not that he lives a morally superior life, like the ethical person, but that he chooses to acknowledge that he's incapable of being morally good, and that he must instead rely on God to live a true and authentic life. So the point Kierkegaard wants to make here is one that I think is still relevant for us today. There's not a sliding scale of moral progress when it comes to the Christian life. One doesn't graduate from pleasure to responsibility to religiosity, as if you can slowly elevate yourself by your own initiative. The sensuous and the ethical are antithetical to the Christian life, and one cannot have a both and. It's either or. When one becomes a Christian, she makes a radical break with her old life of pleasure or responsibility and moral striving and begins a new life of confessing her sin and becoming more and more like Christ. The paradigm for Kierkegaard here is Nicodemus, being born anew, right? Nicodemus is clearly a judge-like figure. He's a part of the moral elite, the Sanhedrin. Not only does he know the law and follow the law, but he is an exemplar of the law to his community. And yet, when he's confronted by Jesus, he's faced with an either-or decision: to remain a member of this prestigious community or to give it all up and become a follower of Jesus Christ. So clearly what Kierkegaard is after here is a common presupposition in Danish culture that Christianity is something you could pursue alongside of a life of culture or leisure. You can be a good person and justify your own existence and have a space within the larger sort of circumference of what is called Christianity. And for Kierkegaard, this simply isn't true because it's not actually centered on Jesus Christ. So with the publication of Either Or, Kierkegaard served notice to Danish society that you could no longer call yourself a Christian in the same way you called yourself a Dane. You could no longer go to Sunday worship in the same way you went to the opera. You had to make a choice. In the name of Jesus, you would have to hate your fatherland and your mother tongue, your culture, for the sake of the gospel. Either or was a harsh rejection of Danish Christianity. At least that's what Kierkegaard thought. It turned out that either or was well received by the cultural elite. And even the queen liked it so much that she had a conference with Kierkegaard. The problem was it was clear that no one actually read it, this 838-page book. It was the sort of thing you bought and put on your shelf to display how sort of culturally sensitive you were. It was sort of David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest or James Joyce's Ulysses, right? Except for the ironic twist that it actually condemned all the people that said they loved it so much. So Kierkegaard had not accomplished his goal with either or. And that leads us finally to the two most important, perhaps, pseudonyms he uses: Johannes Climacus and Anticlimacus. Johannes Climacus means John the Climber. This was originally the name of a 6th century monk who had written about how spiritually we can ascend to God. And so this idea of the climber is sort of this trope of one who wants to pursue knowledge and ascend greater and greater in knowledge. Johannes Climacus, for Kierkegaard, is a non-Christian who is in pursuit of truth. He's an outsider to Christianity, and although he observes Christianity closely and he's jealous of the type of happiness people that call themselves Christians seem to have, he's deeply skeptical of the authenticity of it. And he cannot commit himself to that way of life. You might say Climacus is the supreme rationalist. And for him, Christianity is supremely irrational. So Kierkegaard published two works under the name Climacus: Philosophical Fragments and Concluding Unscientific Postscript. Next week, we're going to look at Philosophical Fragments, and he's going to deal with questions of how do you find the truth? How do you know the truth? Who is the truth, or what is the truth? And ultimately, of course, that's going to be Jesus. Now, if Johannes Climacus is the wise skeptic, Anticlimacus is the sincere believer, the ideal Christian type. Think Dostoevsky's Alyosha Karamazov, or Prince Mishkin, right? The anti here doesn't mean against or contrary to. It means more like the word anti in anticipate or antipasto, right? It means to come before or to precede. And Kierkegaard's going to use the Anticlimacus figure to present an image of a highly devout Christian believer who's always preceding and anticipating Climacus's climb. Because Anticlimacus has something that Johannes Climacus can never have. He's an insider. Remember, Climacus is an outsider to the faith. So all of his judgments about what Christianity is are based upon a preconception of what the truth is and how one learns it. And then he tries to fit Christianity into that, and that's why it doesn't make sense to him. Whereas Anticlimacus, being a believer, thinking through the Christian faith from the inside out, is able to speak to the rationality that Christianity has on its own terms. Now, the reason Kierkegaard published this work pseudonymously as Anticlimacus is because it's actually so sincere in faith that it's sort of nauseating. Nobody really wants to be Anticlimacus. He's too good. And Kierkegaard was worried that if he put his own name on this, people would think that he was sort of boasting of his own amazing faith, when in reality he knew that he was not Anticlimacus, even if he wanted to be. That he was a sinner caught somewhere between these two figures, Johannes and Anticlimacus. In fact, there's a point where he writes that if you want to know who he really is and what he really thinks, you sort of have to triangulate him between these other two pseudonymous authors. So he uses these two positions, the extreme skeptic and the extreme believer, in order to help his readers to see many of the things that they say and do in the name of Christianity are actually not Christian. And that things that Christians actually say they believe are scandalous and irrational on the terms of the culture around them. Now, we're going to pick that up next week because I've run out of time. But just to give you a sense of what we're going to do, next week we're going to specifically tackle these three questions with Climacus and Anticlimacus. What does it mean to know the truth? Who is Jesus and what does he want from us? And how then are we supposed to live as Christians? All right, thank you. I think we have a few minutes left for questions. Yes. Yeah. He was a deeply introspective writer, so he simultaneously kept loads and loads of journals. There's some 50-something volumes that are now published of his journals. And we can sort of biographically trace what he's thinking as he's writing these things. And sometimes he'll quite explicitly say what he wrote and why he wrote it under that name. At the same time of these works that I talked to you about, he simultaneously was publishing under his own name. He would publish devotionals. So they were very simple sort of exegetical devotional statements about the Christian faith and about certain passages of Scripture. And so scholars can sort of use these types of work to triangulate with the other voices. It is a bit nauseating, though, right? It's like dealing with multiple personality disorder sometimes. But yeah, I think... There's a lot of debate about some types of statements, but by and large, there's common agreement about what he thought he was saying and what he meant when he said certain things. Let's go Caesar and then Dale. Yeah, no, for Kierkegaard, the big problem is the relationship between Christianity and culture, right? And he's completely worried that the type of Christianity that he grew up in has become so captive to the culture around it that it's actually not Christianity anymore. And people keep calling it Christianity because that's what they inherited, but they haven't done the work of going back and investigating the Gospels for themselves. I think there's a lot for us to learn from that. I do. Dale. What do I most like about Søren Kierkegaard? He has a sort of iconoclastic appeal, right? And it's very much take no prisoners. What he suffered in his lifetime in terms of isolation because of the positions he took. Took a personal toll on him, and he died very early of ill health. But I think for us today reading his work, we can sort of hear that voice that's always calling us to question our assumptions about what it means to be a Christian. And for me, that's very important. In the back. That's a good question. You know, when you read the journals, he is really naive. He really thinks that the bishop is going to read his book, Practice in Christianity, and is going to say, oh, this is it. Okay, let's all just move back to this vision. Which it constantly leads to a life of disappointment, because that's not how institutions work, right? I don't know if he would have given up or if he would have kept going. He had written so much that even after his death, like, 6 new things were published. I mean, he was just prolific. And he had actually written some things in his lifetime that he had decided not to publish because they were too harsh, he felt. And those obviously came out after his death. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say because society was much smaller then, right? Everybody read every book that was published every year. So they knew what was going on in the culture. Now there's just so much sort of dissemination of information and material that we sort of self-select on the front end to listen to the voices we already like. And people have always done that, but that's what made Kierkegaard so successful, is he was able to do that in a way that sort of forced people to come to terms with the other voices in the conversation. Now you can really opt out of those other voices, right? Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Obviously, I think Kierkegaard is very Western. There's this idea in Western philosophy of sort of the rise of the introspective consciousness, right? The first sort of autobiography comes out of the Western church father, Augustine, and it's sort of a critical examination of his life, right? And a lot of people say that the Lutheran view of Paul and Martin Luther's sort of incessant worrying over his own sin and then his finding freedom in Paul's words is very much his own introspection about his own imperfection and trying to overcome that, right? So I think that's an interesting comment, because I think Kierkegaard very much fits into this line of Paul, Augustine, Luther. He's very preoccupied in a way with finding the truth and being very concerned with the ways in which his own culture prevents him from finding the truth. Yeah, I think for him, at least, part of the point is he knows he can't live it, right? Whereas at least the ethical trope that he uses, right, is the person in culture that has the false assumption that they can live it. But I think you're right. Yeah, no, I do think there are people who are able to draw us closer to the heart of the gospel, right, by pointing out the falsity. And I think there's a little bit of that in every good teacher. I think someone like Eugene Peterson can do that from time to time, right? The problem, of course, with American Christianity is, again, it's sort of a marketplace. So you kind of decide what brand of Christianity do you fit into, and then you already sort of have a preconceived set of authorities that you then listen to their voice on. So even if there is someone who's trying to break the link, like Kierkegaard did, between the authority and the message they're proclaiming and asking you to investigate it again for yourself, even if you find that person, you can always dismiss them as just being whatever you already have decided is a wrong type of Christianity, right? I think that's the real challenge of where we're at. But I think there are people that are trying nonstop to do that. And that's what drew me in my dissertation to a guy named Stanley Hauerwas that I was talking about at the beginning. Yeah. Sorry, I looked over here and like five people had their hands up. Let me go Ron, and then I'm sorry, I don't know your name. Yeah, actually, I don't think that's a related etymology, but I'll look into it. He was just a rich kid. He did not have a job. His books brought almost no money in. No, because money, remember, at this point in time, especially, money and class were not the same thing. So even though he had money, he was still very middle class. There was still a place in society that he could not be, right? Yeah. We have so little time that I didn't want to get into it too much. But this either or, this very intentional decision focus aspect of his work that we talked about is anti-Hegelian. Because for Hegel, right, you have both and. You have the thesis and the counter-thesis, and they come together to form an even greater synthesis that retains both and. But for Kierkegaard, no. You literally forsake everything for the sake of the gospel, or you don't. So making that decision is existential. It's a part of constituting who you are, right? I'm seeing Jordan wave at my hand. We're out of time. All right. Good news is we have another week. And so I'm going to try to keep next week maybe even shorter for more time to talk. And I'm going to be available afterwards if you want to ask me questions we didn't get to ask here. Thank you.